This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our Radio Main Street across North Dakota. Today we're going to start our show with Kirsten Baszler. She is the superintendent of the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction. She's running for re-election, her third term. She's been in the office since 2012. Kirsten, thanks for joining us today.
Why, thank you for having me on. I appreciate the time and I appreciate the opportunity, as always, to talk about education and the importance of school and families.
Well, we've got a big election coming up, so let's get that out of the way first. What would you want to do with a third term?
So this is, and actually it's the reason that I ran for a third term. It's been very important for me to continue the good work. We've had so much momentum going as we've moved through the last 7.5 years together. We've accomplished so many things together as a state. As I look forward to what we're going to continue to do, I think we've made the Office of the Department of Public Instruction so much more efficient and really focused on what our mission is as a state agency. Our mission is to serve our students who are our primary customers and their families. And so as we move through the COVID, that's become even more important to serve our students and regardless of which environment they are in and make sure that they and their teachers go home safely every night to the families that they go home to. So as I've worked in the Department of Public Instruction, I obviously saw some things that could become more efficient and be better operationalized. And so over the last 7.5 years, I've decreased our DPI's base operations and salary budget by over $1 million. And I think that that's a very important thing, because as we look to create efficiencies and save our taxpayer dollars, it's really important to do that as state leaders so we can get the services out at a high quality fashion, but while we're saving our taxpayer dollars and becoming very efficient. I know that, you know, my opponent has increased his operations budget by almost $1 million in that same time frame. So I think it's important for us to be focused on making sure that we are fiscally responsible users while keeping that service high. Another thing that I'm really proud of is we've saved our families over more than $4 million in college tuition by bringing college credit courses to our high schools. It's incredibly important as our young people go off that we are making them and preparing them choice ready, getting them ready for whatever they choose to do to make the best choice once they leave high school. And that would mean, you know, some of them are ready to go to a four-year university, or it might be a trade school or a tech school. Some of them are ready to enter the workforce because some of the classes that they've taken in high school. Some of them are choosing to serve our country honorably in the military. So we need to make sure that we keep doing those things, bringing those opportunities to all of our school districts across the state. At this point, some of our school districts are offering our classes and some of them aren't. And we really need to make sure that we are offering these college courses and these college savings to all of our families in the state of North Dakota, not just certain zip codes. We have really worked hard and we will continue to work on. That's one of the main reasons that I am running for re-election is to continue to improve our transparency and our accountability to the public. We've created the Insights website to tell taxpayers exactly how much a school spends in each district and how those students in that district are doing with that money that's being given to that district. So I'll continue to work on that because I believe it's important that we are accountable to the taxpayers who actually pay the bills for our public education system, to the families and the students that we serve. So we, again, are working for that transparency to make sure that all of our high schools are graduating more and more students who are ready to enter into the workforce, ready for the military, or ready for college. But there are some school districts, some high schools in the state that still need some additional support that aren't graduating their students choice ready. And so we got to concentrate and make sure that those school districts have the leadership that they need. Unfortunately, my opponent's school district is one of those that is going backwards, and we want to continue to help those students as well.
Well, I just want to get into the big issue of the year, and that is one that disrupted the school year back in spring and is looming large again as schools get ready to reopen in a couple of weeks, and that is COVID-19 preparation. How has the pandemic changed your routine? Are you getting a lot of inquiries, or how is it affecting what you do?
You know, that's exactly what I was going to transition to. So I think that the COVID has disrupted everyone's lives. There's not a single system or entity in this nation that hasn't been deeply impacted, and education, K-12 education, is not immune for that. The most important thing that I see that has come out of that is it has given us an opportunity to stay connected, become even more connected with our families. The school-to-home connection has become even stronger, and it needs to remain strong through this year. And I see that happening. I think that's why I feel so blessed to be a leader in North Dakota at this time. So one of the things that has significantly changed in my routine is where I would meet with my family cabinet once every quarter for a full 8 hours. I'm meeting during the spring, I was meeting every week with my family cabinet. I was meeting every week with the student cabinet to make sure that those people that I was elected to serve, that they had a voice and that I had an understanding of what our students, their families, and our teachers needed throughout all of this. And so we've significantly increased our communication with those people that we serve. I think over 180 hours of either telephone conversations, meetings, and Q&As have been held since March 15th. We'll continue to do that. The legislature provided an opportunity for me to create some pilot programs in the state to train schools on how to better engage families and how to become true, more authentic partners with them. And so the COVID has obviously impacted that. We have been doing the training via online. And I believe the other most significant thing that I've seen this COVID change in the day-to-day routine is the work as one government approach. I've always been very proud of the department team that we've built and the way that we have broken down our silos within our office, become more efficient working together. But now we've also done that by breaking down the silos among agencies. Just stepped out of a meeting and it included local public health, it included North Dakota IT, it included North Dakota Department of Health, it included people from the governor's office, it included so many people that are just different agencies, it included people from the Department of Human Services sharing their skills and experience, what they learned from reopening long-term care facilities. All of these people working together that are, you know, paid for, elected to do the work to help people has really come through in this pandemic time.
Local control is kind of the mantra of public schools generally. Is that the best way to deal with a global pandemic, though? I mean, should there be some central control? You just suggested that you were working with, you know, other governmental agencies. Should the state schools be following, you know, all these different ways of doing it, or should they be, because of the nature of the infection and the fact that students interact with each other? What's the best way to proceed in terms of guiding all these various districts across the state?
I think people listening across the state really understand the diversity. And so I want to be clear that this group that we're working, this multi-state agency group that is working, we're working to gather to marshal resources, if you will, to make sure that when our locals have questions or need additional support from the state, that there's a place for them to go to and there's a process and a procedure and protocols that we can advise them to take. That is far different than the state making decisions for locales. Government coming in to provide assistance and marshal resources for a community is very different than a government coming in and stepping in and telling a local community what to do. So the answer, to cut to the chase, you know, is that the best way in a pandemic? Should we just be making decisions on a statewide level? I have 129 school districts, Doug, that have less than 300 students, kindergarten through 12. I have 80 of those districts have less than 100. That's a far different situation. I have some school districts that are a one-room schoolhouse and there's 14 kids in them and all of those kids are cousins and they're having dinner together. So to make a state-level decision with the diversity of confirmed cases is a stretch. To make a statewide decision when you include the diversity of confirmed cases and community spread along with the diversity of what type of culture, community, and students are enrolled in those schools is far too overreaching of a one-size-fits-all. It just wouldn't work.
Is there reason for concern about this year's standardized tests?
Well, you know, I'm really glad you asked me that question. So right now is not a time for us to not know where our students are. Using those tests for accountability would be a very poor decision. Using that single test of an assessment as an accountability factor to measure our school's quality, or even, you know, if, God forbid, a teacher's quality, would be a mistake. But it's not time for us to back away from providing a tool to know where our students are, because that tool will tell us what we need to do to help our students. Those teachers need to know where their students are in reading and writing and mathematics so they know how to help them. Obviously, it won't just be the only tool. They'll be doing formative assessments. They'll be, you know, they'll be just assessing by just simply being with their child, either in a Zoom classroom or a face-to-face classroom. But that standardized test will tell us as a state, where are our students? What do I need to provide to our legislature as far as state-level data to say this is where our kids are in North Dakota, and so these are the efforts that we need to take when they convene, however they may convene in January of 2021. So now's not the time to back away from those assessments to know where our kids are. We have superheroes in our classroom, we call them teachers, that need to know that information, but we can't use that state assessment for accountability.
How about remedial ed, though? I mean, there's probably reason to assume that there might be an increased need for it, given the disruption that happened in spring and the different kind of schooling that students will be facing when they return to classes in a couple of weeks.
Absolutely. So some students really flourished and accelerated during this time. They were able to go at a faster pace, or they were able to really dig into subjects that they didn't have time for because they weren't really active this spring with any activities, and they weren't, you know, going to baseball games or to track meets. And so some of them really did accelerate. Some students flourished. Some teachers flourished. Some students struggled. Some teachers struggled. So what we like to say is, every student is exactly where they need to be. No student is ahead. No student is behind. They're exactly where they need to be. And our teachers are going to get them to the next level. They will get them to the next level. So the remediation point for that is why, as part of our agreement, as part of the governor's executive order, the governor required that within the first 4 weeks of this school year, that every school district did some assessment of every student kindergarten through 12th grade to learn and assess where they were in the core subject areas, to make sure that student was going to pick up their learning where they left off and make sure that we weren't leaving any gaps, or what I call sometimes Swiss cheese education, where we have holes in our foundational understanding of mathematics or grammar.
So is the DPI looking at improvements for alternate instruction? I know that during the spring, things were just kind of hurly-burly, moving around very quickly, and teachers who were used to teaching, you know, in front of a class were online. Some teachers are probably better than others. Are teachers going to be expected to produce more than one lesson plan, an online and a classroom one, or how is this all going to work?
So this spring, rightfully so, a lot of grace was given. Grace was given to schools. Grace was given to students, to teachers, to families. We were all trying to operate and find out who we were and where we were going in these new conditions of our world. So a grace was given, and it was right to have that grace given. But as we look to the full 2021 school year, we understood that there needed to be higher expectations. There needed to be, we couldn't allow another 9 weeks or another few weeks even of learning that was not new learning, that wasn't stretching our students' minds and getting them where they needed. So when the governor and I came out with the guidance for the distance learning plans, we did say that it needed to be school board approved and improvements needed to be made to that distance learning plan. School districts needed to detail very explicitly how they were going to measure student attendance and engagement, how they were going to take grades, and how that would be across the board. And each school district needed to determine what those grades needed to be and how that attendance and engagement would be measured. And so the expectations are higher. But with higher expectations, it's always been my rule, whether I way back in the day when I was a classroom teacher and I had high expectations for my students, or when I was an assistant principal and I had high expectations for the teachers, and even when I was the school board president in Mandan, when you have high expectations, that means that you provide the resources and the support that is necessary to get those people to those expectations that our students deserve. And so the governor and I also announced, I believe a couple of weeks ago, the support that we're providing every student in the state of North Dakota. All 120,000 students will have access to a precision learning tool that they can enroll in. Teachers can use it as part of their classroom. School districts can use it as part of their district's distance learning plan. But even if your teacher doesn't use it, or if your district isn't engaging in it, as a family member, as a student yourself, you can enroll yourself in this precision learning tool for mathematics, reading, and writing. And this precision learning tool sets forth a pathway, a map for you, built specifically around your ability and where your strengths and weaknesses are, to take you through a very unique individual plan of academic lessons. We have that available to all of our students, public, private, homeschooled, tribal, all students for the next 14 months. And that's, so the governor and I provided that. We hope that that'll provide some assistance to our teachers needing to develop multiple different lesson plans for the unique levels of teaching and learning. And that suite also has professional development for our teachers so they can become better teachers at teaching online. The other thing is we also know that the students with our special education needs, students that have need some extra help and additional assistance because of some, you know, learning disabilities or sometimes physical disabilities. We're providing support to Minot State University to get more special education teachers, our paraprofessionals that are out there working with our students with special needs already. We're working to get them licensed and certified. So again, we are having higher expectations, and that the state, like good government should, is stepping in to provide the support and assistance that's necessary. Because bottom line is, we need to have our students have a high quality education, regardless of their learning environment this year, regardless of their zip code. And the state needs to make sure that our teachers have what they need so our students and families have what they need.
Kirsten Basler is the North Dakota Superintendent of Public Instruction. Kirsten, let's get to some nitty gritty here. What is the expectation of protective equipment for students and teachers and staff when they do engage in the same space? Are they all going to be masked? Are they going to be socially distanced? Are things going to be timed and scheduled so that there aren't clusters of people? How is all this going to work?
So that's what our school districts are putting together right now. I would encourage everyone, all of our listeners, to really, if you have anyone that you love, whether it's your daughter that happens to be a teacher, or your son who happens to be a teacher, or maybe you have your neighbor lady down the street is a crossing guard or a food nutrition worker, anybody that has somebody that they care about working in our public schools, I encourage you to go on your school district's website. It's required that every school district have their health and safety plan and their distance learning plan approved by the school board and published on their public website. And it's a requirement in the governor's executive order that these plans are developed in collaboration with our local public health units and with students, families, faculty, and staff. And so the mask issue is one that has lots of diversity across the state, as you can imagine. Most of our larger school districts with the thousands of students in them are requiring masks when social distancing is not possible. They are working with their local public health to work out the finer details of when it might be okay for the students not to have their masks on if they're outside in Fayette, when it might not be possible at all when they're in a band or a choir room. At that point, we're asking those school districts to ensure that the social distancing of 6 feet or more can be adhered to. So the local school boards, who are elected members of their community, have the final say on that issue, and they do have the authority. I know that several people have called our office, questioning whether or not they had the authority to require masks. It's been upheld in many Supreme Court cases that school districts are able to require certain things for public health and or health in general. They require shoes. Sometimes they even require that dresses can't be so short.
What about teachers? a lot of teachers, especially teachers of a certain age, may be more apprehensive about this coming school year than they would have been years past. I know of one teacher in particular that I've known for a long time who's just retired because she didn't want to face the uncertainty of this health issue. Are you seeing resignations? Is there a concern about teaching staff?
So, yes, you know, and those, and I understand that, and my heart goes out to those teachers that have taught for so many years, and what a way to have to make a decision. But the, so some teachers are considering and making those decisions. We're also worried about substitute teachers. So substitute teachers, yes, is another significant issue. So working with the Education Standards and Practices Board, that's another state entity outside the purview of DPI that does the licensing. But I work, again, another example of working closely with your partners and working with Dr. Pitkin, who's the executive director of that board. We're monitoring that closely. We're collecting information to see if there is a, if there's going to be a crisis in a severe shortage of substitute teachers, if somebody, you know, does get sick or if there is an outbreak. So we're monitoring that. But preliminarily, here's what I just heard last night, is that while some subs have, substitute teachers have chosen to not be included on the list this year, others, because of different working situations, have signed on for the first time. So, you know, some school districts, and these are generally in our larger, more metropolitan areas, if you can call North Dakota having any metropolitan area, the substitute list seems to be about even. We are watching every year. The Department of Public Instruction is tasked with determining how many shortage areas there are, how many vacancies or unfilled teaching positions are in the state. We will again collect that, and we generally have that data by about October, when everything starts to settle down and contracts are settled in and vacancies are filled. So we'll have a stronger handle on that and a better update in October when we have the unfilled vacancies. But again, you know, having a problem and not finding a solution, about 4 years ago, really identifying that we needed to, that we have teacher shortages in North Dakota. So we partnered with some other agencies in North Dakota, and we've created a free online one-stop shop for all school districts searching for specific teachers in specific content areas and for people that want to share their resume or look for jobs. And so I just encourage you to go to DPI's website if you're either looking for a teaching job or are in need of a teacher this year.
Kirsten Baszler is the North Dakota Superintendent of Public Instruction. She's running for re-election, and this would be her third term if she was successful. Kirsten, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Doug. I appreciate it. And thank you once again and your listeners for their interest in education.
Coming up on Main Street, letters from World War I. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The state's Department of Commerce says the demand for economic resilience grants has been very strong. Those grants are to help businesses provide a safe environment and to help restore consumer confidence. Businesses can receive up to $50,000 for a single location, and if the business has multiple locations, then they can receive up to $100,000. James Lehman is Director of Economic Development and Finance at the Commerce Department. He says the department has been surprised at the interest in the program.
We're seeing geographic diversity, company size diversity, as well as sector diversity throughout the state, which encourages us because we think we hit the nail on the head with the need here.
Lamon says it's not just restaurants and bars who have applied.
The list is pretty extensive in terms of who qualified for this. Again, it's having a marketplace to where people might have been reluctant to come to your establishment, or if you're a manufacturer, for example, you're part of a supply chain that can't be disrupted. I mean, we saw what happened with various foods and toilet paper and everything during the onset of COVID. So we have a pretty diverse, like I said, sector by sector demand for this particular product.
Lamon says this the turnaround time for approval of the grants is about 2 weeks. He says there's still some money left, and he's encouraging businesses to contact the Commerce Department or the local economic development agency if they are interested.
It is first come, first served basis.
North Dakota's top elections officer says residents who plan to vote by mail should prepare to send back their ballots without delay. North Dakota is one of 46 states warned by the Postal Service that it cannot guarantee on-time delivery of completed ballots. Secretary of State Al Jager says voters must request the ballots unless they voted by mail in June.
They don't automatically get sent out. The voters have to apply, and those ballots will be sent out 40 days out from the election because on the domestic side, voters in North Dakota can begin casting their ballot on September 24th.
Ballots must be postmarked on or before Election Day, but Jager says they'll be accepted until the state canvassing board meets on the following Monday. Absentee ballots can be requested at vote.nd.gov. And today marks the start of the sugar beet harvest in the Red River Valley. The harvest outlook this year is better than it was a year ago. Last fall, wet conditions meant growers left about a third of the crop in the ground. American Crystal Sugar agronomist Joel Hastings says conditions are looking better this year.
We have some groundouts in the field, in the ditches and low-lying areas where we did lose some acres. But overall, we think we have a pretty darn decent crop coming.
Farmers will harvest enough of the sugar beets to keep 5 processing plants going. In October, when it's cool enough to store sugar beets, the harvest ramps up. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by AARP North Dakota, providing caregiving resources, healthy living information, tips for families to avoid scams, and connecting with communities at fun events. They're creating real possibilities here in North Dakota. AARP.org/ND.
The murder of James Reeb in 1965 caused a national outcry.
One good man, a man of God, was killed.
But in Selma, Alabama, things were unusually quiet.
Why is it so hard to find these people who know about Reeb?
NPR's investigation into the murder of a civil rights activist continues with the trial of 3 suspects. On the next White Lies from NPR.
White Lies coming up tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Joseph Stewart. He is an associate professor of history at the University of Mary, and we're going to talk to him about something we actually first discussed a couple of years ago. It's a play that he produced with his colleague, Daniel Belinsky, and it's titled North Dakota Voices of the Great War, and of course it would have been produced around the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I. Joseph Stewart joins us from Bismarck. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, sir.
You know, when we talked with you and your colleague, Daniel Belinsky, when this play was first produced, what were your expectations and how were they met when you finally got it on stage at the Belle Mayhews?
Sure. Yeah. Well, so we worked with students both in the theater and in the history programs here at the University of Mary, and we didn't know really what to expect. We were actually quite nervous at first because we had no script. This was going to be an original creation, and we knew that we wanted the students to have input into how this was going to shake out. So we had all the letters. We had created a database. The students were transcribing them by the hundreds, and then we were going through them and just, you know, picking up random ones to see, okay, what do you think about this one, and what about this idea, and then just piecing it together. And my colleague, Danny Belinsky, just did an amazing job sort of directing this whole process. And meanwhile, I was sort of supporting with the history students. And the students were all together creating the scenes, you know, practicing pronunciation of different words, you know, just dealing with a letter as a letter. It was interesting. You know, most of our students had never written letters before, as is the case of this generation. And so they were, you know, really just amazed at the depth of communication that was present in these letters. And so it was watching the joy of that develop and the original creativity from the students, and then that week sort of guiding them, just created, a really special production when it was finally done.
You know, you just described something that I think is important that I realize in my own life. It used to be before instant communication anywhere in the world, we actually sat down and thought about what we were going to write. And so these letters probably have a fair amount of important historical content that we sort of lose into the vapor these days.
Oh, they sure do. Yeah, I mean, we found 1,400 of them that had been lovingly cut out of newspapers, because when the young people would write home, the parents would take the letters from their young people and then they would get them published in the local newspapers, kind of like we post things to Facebook or something or online somewhere. They would take it and get it published in the local papers. And those are the letters then that were cut out and put in a scrapbook by people over in the State Historical Society of North Dakota.
Well, I remember my father actually was a newspaper reporter in Detroit Lakes, Minnesota, when he was a young man. And when he enlisted in the Army, He was away at boot camp in Louisiana, and he was writing letters back to his newspaper telling people what the experience was like. And his uncle had been gassed in World War One and suffered from that
right?
for the rest of his life. So these are moments that really have a family resonance to them as well.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because we had a student who was going through records and suddenly came over to us and said, I just found a letter from my great-great-great-grandfather. And he transcribed it, and he kept it private to himself for a while, and then he took it home for Christmas that after the semester was out. And with his, all of his extended family assembled together at Christmas, he read them this letter, which had been lost to the family.
Wow. That must have been something.
Yeah, it really was.
Well, let's go back a little further here. How did this collaboration come to be? Because you're in history. Daniel Belinsky is in theater. He runs the theater at U Mary. So how did you cross paths, and how did this, you know, flame begin?
Yeah. So I was, a number of years ago, on the North Dakota World War One Centennial Committee that was being headed up by Daryl Dorgan to sort of lead efforts around the state of North Dakota to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the First World War. And so while I was interacting with different people on that committee, the idea came up and said, the idea of, well, let's find some original letters and do something with them during this time. And so I organized some history students, and we went over to the state archives, and we discovered this scrapbook collection that I mentioned of 1,400 letters, and we were delighted. And so we began going through them and creating a database and having so much fun with this. And so then I thought, well, let's do at least a reader's theater, which is sort of a low-key, informal sort of students kind of get up and just read from the letters and maybe have some uniforms on and things, and we could do that over at the Heritage Center or something. So we did that for a year, and I asked my colleague, Daniel Belinsky, who happens to have an office two doors down from mine, and I said, hey, I've never done a reader's theater before. Would you help us? And he very generously agreed and came along, and that's how he got exposed to the letters even while he was working on, you know, other plays and other things. But then he started to realize, wow, these letters are really powerful. And I remember looking at him and saying, wow, I'm so glad that somebody else sees that, not just me, the historian, but somebody outside the field can appreciate the power of these letters. And he said, absolutely. And so he proposed, let's do something next fall. So that was fall 2018. Let's do something together. Let's collaborate on and work together to create something with the students.
Oh, that's great. So you had 1,400 letters. If you'd read them all, of course, you'd have a day-long show. How did you pick the elements that you did?
Oh, goodness, that's a wonderful question. So I guess, you know, it comes down to dramatic elements. And, you know, what are the dramatic stories that really grip the emotions and grip the heart and challenge a person to imagine what's going on and also to go more deeply about the meaning behind what's going on? And so we tried to, you know, work with the students to begin identifying those. And you know what? Frankly, some of the students found the best ones. And they would read them aloud in class, and I would just look at them and saying, that is going in the play. We just all sort of knew it. We just looked at each other, and we just, like, you know, unanimous, that is going in the play. There's no question. And so it was just, yeah, really a trial and error and just going through them. I guess it did help to create a database in Excel so that we could then search for different terms. So if we wanted, okay, we want a little bit more information about this person or that event, we could search it and say, okay, it's in that letter and that letter. Let's go get it. But the main thing was looking for those dramatic elements that we could then tie together to create the story.
So did Daniel Belinsky create kind of an arc there then? Did he take these letters and kind of create a dramatic arc?
Yes, that's exactly right. That is what happened. We supplied him with all these letters and we said, look, we think these are amazing. What do you think? And he took them home, I think, and he must have stayed up all night and just sort of went through them and I think had a eureka moment and drew it all together, and we were just amazed at how they fit together. And then after that, we just worked together to kind of adjust it. So we'd make suggestions, let's do a little more of this, a little less of that. And then, you know, during rehearsals, and I remember just sitting there and just commenting, and the students, of course, had more ideas, and then it came together from there.
You know, when I was a young boy, the one thing I did not realize about World War One was how briefly the United States was in it. It's really,
that's right.
1918 is the year. They'd helped the Allied causes before that, but they weren't actually fighting until later in 1918, and the war ends in November of 1918.
That's right. That's exactly right.
So let's talk about setting the scene, if you will. You've got a few snippets from the play script that you're going to share with us. Let's talk about the experience of being under fire?
Midway through the play, we have some letters talking about the experience in the trenches, and one of them that we found goes like this, and this is definitely in the play. Those shells were all around us, this soldier writes. Trees were crashing to the ground as though a cyclone was on. One of those shells will fell a tree 3 feet thick, just like it was a matchstick. Some of the shells burst into the air, and the screams of the flying pieces of steel whizzed past our heads, together with the explosions of those which burst on the ground. It made one think all hell had broken loose. I can't figure out how I wasn't killed.
Yeah.
That scene then fades out and is replaced by a new scene that comes on. So you get little glimpses of like of the life that these guys are leading, you know, in the midst of the trenches, up to their knees in mud, with diseased feet, and just these horrendous kind of conditions that they're under.
Yes, it's a reminder that war is glorious only to a very few people, not the people who are on the front lines. That's for sure.
That's right, and that actually was a fine line that we wanted to walk in this play, which was, how do we honor the veterans and the people who are in this and the cause for which they fought? But how do we also show the horrendous side of this and not glamorize war? And that was a really something that we really tried to keep in mind. And I think we succeeded because we had many veterans in the audience, and some of them came more than once to the play and with tears in their eyes. And so I think we tried to walk that line because it's an important one.
A long time ago, I read a poem by Wilfred Owen, Dulce et Decorum Est Pro Patria More. It is sweet and fitting to die for our country. And that is said with a real arched eyebrow in the poem. It's an ugly story in a way. But that kind of recollection of a war, for that matter, Peter Jackson's They Shall Not Grow Old, this amazing documentary that he created, slowing down the film and coloring it, it takes us to a place that was just devastation. And I think that's what that piece you just read reminded me of.
It was so devastating to the psychology and the soul of the Western civilization and even of beyond that, I mean, it's the first moment when the word machine is linked to the word gun in the popular imagination. Before then, machines were seen as benevolent forces that are, you know, help us to progress, right? But now you have machines that are killing people, and people realize, wow, the science and technology have a massively destructive potential. And so that raises all kinds of ethical questions about, you know, what direction even is progress.
Joseph Stewart is an associate professor of history at the University of Mary. We're talking about his collaboration with colleague Daniel Belinsky, who runs the theater department there, on the play North Dakota Voices of the Great War. Joseph, another element of that Great War was that there was significant opposition to it in the United States before we finally got there. And a lot of that opposition was in places like North Dakota and Minnesota, which had ethnic populations that, frankly, were conflicted by this.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, especially North Dakota was very anti-war up until the declaration of war because they saw it as sort of an East Coast sort of manipulation to try to, you know, get money for the war industry and big business out east. And so they were very opposed to it. They were very German as well. And so that played into it. But war was declared. North Dakota was complete 180-degree turn. I mean, we're talking almost universal support for it and volunteering in very high levels. We actually had the highest percentage of nurses volunteers of any state in the country. So it really was quite a remarkable shift.
So these young people who did the play that was produced at Belle Mayhus a couple of years ago were actually age appropriate, maybe even slightly older than the typical soldiers would have been at the time. And that's unusual too. We usually see war movies and people are like in their 30s and 40s, or they would more likely be teenagers. So they're playing age-appropriate roles. I'm also wondering, though, what about ethnic accents? Because back then, North Dakota was German, Norwegian, Russian.
Yeah.
It was a melange of different voices.
Oh, that's exactly right. In fact, one of the most amazing things about doing this project was seeing the students of the same age as the people that they were playing. And I think that that really made an impression on them too. I remember getting different comments from some of the students realizing, wow, like these were people that really were alive, had their own hopes and dreams in their lives, and they were the same age as us. And they were just sort of, you know, staring off into space, sort of thinking about that and talking to me about it. And so they were very much moved by that. The second point you made about different languages, we have a scene with a German soldier who is captured, and they exchange some lines in German and in English, and they try to translate, try to understand each other. And then there's a scene where one of the German soldiers begins to sing Stille Nacht, or Silent Night.
Yes.
And the lights sort of go dim around the rest of the stage, and the spotlight shines on him. And it's just this beautiful solo that just sort of floats across this desolated scene of war, of Silent Night, was just haunting, just absolutely haunting.
Well, earlier on in the war, before 1918, there was that famous Christmas armistice, if you will, that where the front lines kind of interacted with each other and then went back to war.
That's right.
Story is also told during the time of the Spanish flu pandemic. And of course, that has relevance to today. When you were producing this play, it was part of the history. Now it's what we're living as well.
That's right.
How did you deal with the pandemic?
Yeah, so let me preface that by just saying that for those listeners who are interested in sort of following up on this, because of its relevance directly to us today in our own pandemic experience, the play is published and is available on Amazon.com. If you just search for North Dakota Voices of the Great War, North Dakota Voices of the Great War, under books, then you'll find it and be able to sort of go into this in more depth. But I wanted to share this one scene from the Great Influenza Epidemic, because this was an event utterly tragic. In fact, it was so tragic that there aren't even a lot of records and memories of it, because it was so painful. Whole families in our state of North Dakota would be found dead in their cabin. And because we had so many nurses and doctors who had volunteered and were over in France, our health system was immediately swamped and overwhelmed. And there were 1,300 people who died in our state officially, but the numbers were certainly much higher than that. But there were many examples of courage and self-sacrifice that are very inspiring, I think, to us today in facing what we are. But this just brief one scene here from a nurse that we found. She writes, "We had every form of infectious and contagious disease in that ward, with only curtains separating each case. The influenza epidemic of 1918 was a never-to-be-forgotten experience. In our camp, I believe there were nearly 5,000 cots, row on row, head to foot, all filled with boys hit by the flu. Five of our nurses died too."
Wow.
And then it goes on from there.
That's a reminder that it was a world war. It was a pandemic.
That's
things
right.
Could be worse, I guess.
Things could be a lot worse. Yeah.
Now, did you do any updating for the script that you published? As you mentioned, it's available on Amazon now.
Yeah. So we went through it with a fine tooth comb, and we won a grant from outside. I should say where we got. Very happy and grateful for support from the Dakota West Arts Council for this project, from a University of Mary research grant, and also from Humanities North Dakota. And that grant money together allowed us to have this professionally done, really. So, you know, we got all the little bugs out of it, and it's all nice and cleaned up. And there's an essay at the end called "The War to Start All Wars" that I wrote, which is sort of talks about the history of the First World War and the sort of the bigger context of it to help us understand some of the significant themes that that are surrounding this. So.
Well, that is important, too. Joseph Stewart is an associate professor of history at UMary, and we're talking about this North Dakota Voices of the Great War play that he collaborated with Daniel Belinsky and lots of students as well. And that is an important part of the story, Joseph, and that is what happened as a result of World War I. It was not the war to end all wars.
No. No, that's right. And boy, I wish we had another hour to talk about this. But no, that's right. It was very much an idealism of trying to end war and make the war safe for democracy. But in fact, it was a chain reaction. It actually started new wars even while this war was going on. So you've got the Russian Revolution, and then right after you have the Greco-Turkish War, and then the Finnish Civil War, and then the Russian Civil War, and then direct connections into World War II, which launches the Cold War. So it's really, one historian called it the original sin of the 20th century. And I think that is the best two-word description of the First World War. It was the original sin. That was Simon Schama said that, the original sin of the 20th century, and that is without doubt.
Well, when you staged this at the Belle Mayhus in 2018, I'm told that there was music from the period, some poetry as well. Can you describe sort of the wrapping that the play was presented in?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we did work with the music department, and we had period music, just wonderful. Like the opening scene, for example, Old Churchyard, that was just beautifully performed. I was humming it for weeks and weeks afterward because it was so haunting. And then we had cellos, and we had singers, and we had poetry from the time, including the poem that you mentioned, Dulce et Decorum Est, that one and other great poems to sort of punctuate different parts of the play and sort of enunciate the deeper themes that we were trying to communicate through the letters. And so it made it a real sort of feast of the arts, so to speak.
Well, Wilfred Owen, the poet who wrote that poem, died in the war. So it's kind of emblematic of the story you're telling. And are you collaborating on anything in the future now? I mean, this sounds like it really worked well.
It really worked well. And we are working on another play for tentatively called Settling Dakota Prairie. And it will be based in the 1870s to 1890s. And we're looking at records of pioneers coming in, all different ethnic and religious backgrounds, people coming into this state. And our main question that we're after is, how did people help each other? Like, how did they collaborate between Native Americans and people coming in, between different families, different ethnic groups? How did people collaborate to survive in a harsh environment? So that's the kind of the take. It's going to perform locally here this fall, and then we'll see what happens to it after that.
Well, we look forward to talking to you and Daniel about that. But before we end this discussion, how about you putting a little button on it? Give us some lines from the end of your play.
Yeah, I would love to, because at the end, what happens is the letters that have been read throughout the play are delivered back home, so to speak, to the people of North Dakota, and the letters are handed them, and then they're reading them, and then they hand the letters to some modern students. So as if across time, across 100 years of time, so that we have found those letters. And so the very end of the play, we have a nurse who's reading from a letter, and she says this: "I suppose I could tell about the sick and the wounded boys I cared for, or about walking in mud knee-deep to get to the wards, or eating the canned food and living in the cold, all of which we did. But they are not the things I want to remember." Then she looks up from the letter directly at the audience. "I like to remember the opportunities I had to be of service to my girls, to my boys, to my country. These are what I remember, and I thank God that He gave me the chance to serve them."
Joseph Stewart, Associate Professor of History at the University of Mary. Joseph, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome, sir. Thank you.
Dakota Datebook is next.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Support is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well.
And by Villa St. Vincent, the Summit of Crookston, where health, independence, and choice come to life through short-term care, rehabilitation, skilled nursing services, memory care, and assisted living. A member of the Benedictine Health System. VillaSt.Vincent.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 18th. Celebrating the 100th year since the passage of the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote. This series is written and voiced by Sarah Walker.
On this date in 1920, Tennessee became the 36th state to ratify the federal woman's suffrage bill, meeting the 3/4 majority required to pass the 19th Amendment. The bill had easily passed the Tennessee Senate, but had remained deadlocked in the State House of Representatives. Finally, young Harry Byrne, whose own constituents were locked in debate and swelling in anti-suffrage ranks, changed his nay to an aye, creating uproar in the room. Another representative, a staunch anti-suffragist, changed his vote as well so that he could propose voting again, but nothing would change. Suffrage passed. Representative Byrne received a lot of criticism for his vote, but defended his decision, stating that he believed in the right of suffrage. He also paid homage to his mother and her advice. She had written to him, "Hurrah and vote for suffrage and don't keep them in doubt." Byrne also noted, "I desired that my party in both state and nation might say that it was a Republican from the East Mountains of Tennessee who made national woman suffrage possible at this date, not for personal glory, but for the glory of his party." The passage of the 19th Amendment had been a long, arduous fight for suffragists nationwide, who had been urging state legislatures for more than a year to pass the amendment before the next presidential election. Of course, the fight for women's suffrage began much earlier. Women in North Dakota alone had sought suffrage a multitude of times since 1868. Their path consisted of many defeats, with some victories. By 1917, partial suffrage had been granted in the state. Women could vote for presidential electors and certain offices in municipal elections. Because of this, North Dakota women had joined a select, elite group of women who would be able to vote for the next president, even if the 19th Amendment had not passed. Following this momentous day, the Bismarck Tribune issued a pro-suffrage statement, noting that women would not permit socialism to reign or tolerate any perceived inequalities or unfairness in matters of government. Quote, "Equal suffrage is welcomed by all good citizens in North Dakota. 36 states have spoken. No power now can keep long from women that which they have fought for and earned." End quote. This is Sarah Walker.
This series is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota and the North Dakota Women's Suffrage Centennial Commission, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
The Morning Edition Song Project invites musicians to write about these turbulent times.
I think eyes are open right now. I think hearts have a wider capacity of love and empathy at this moment. We have to seize it with open conversations and love, you know?
How a Nashville soul singer views the pandemic as an opportunity for change on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As you know, as we broadcast, we stream live at prairiepublic.org. And after the broadcast, you can find any Main Street show as a podcast at prairiepublic.org. Wednesday on our show, we'll feature a discussion about the process for developing a safe and effective vaccine for COVID-19. An excerpt from the Conversations on Healthcare podcast looks at the complex process of testing vaccines, as well as the global supply chain that would be needed to distribute billions of doses. And News Director Dave Thompson will have the third installment of his Energy Issues and Answers series. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.